My name is Lou Ellen White, and I'm an assistant professor in the First People Studies program at Concordia University, and also Mohawk. My family is from the community of Ogwesasne.
And you have recently published a book called Free to Move Mohawk, Indigenous Education at the Ogwesasne Freedom School. Do you mind explaining a bit about the school and why it was set up?
The Ogwesasne Freedom School started in 1979, and it's a grassroots program that was started by community members from concerned parents. And it actually grew out of some political division in the community. There was it was a really tumultuous time in the community. So parents gathered together, and community members and volunteered, and said, we need to educate our own children. And it didn't start out as a language immersion program until 1984. So it started out as a cultural we had a cultural foundation from the very beginning. So volunteers would come, and parents and community members and even outsiders came in to support the community. And they taught children in their living rooms and the garages and the barn, wherever there was a space. And they took them out on medicine walks, and they used Ogwesasne Notes, which was a newspaper out of the community at the time. And so there was a real effort at focusing on the cultural foundation of the Mohawk people, or the Haudenosaunee people. But that conflict at the time caused such a division in the community that there was an encampment at a location called Racket Point on the reserve, which is within the boundaries of New York State. But there were traditional Mohawks, and those who were traditional Mohawks, meaning those who followed the traditional ways of the longhouse, and then those who were supportive of the elected council system and supported the police. So there was a standoff that had happened with a community member, a traditional member, and who was being arrested. And so there were all kinds of scuffles that led up to this major encampment in which the traditional members were trying to protest the arresting of this traditional leader in the community. And that was a standoff that lasted for 2 years. So out of that is how the Freedom School really emerged. It was, we can't send our children away to be educated in public schools anymore because they're not getting their language, they're not getting their culture. We're standing up for our rights to self-governance. We need to stand up for our rights to self-education as well. So we're going to start our own school.
And the school takes quite an innovative approach to education. Instead of the state controlling the education, the school puts education back into the hands of the people and the hands of the community. So how has the school managed to maintain this independence from the state? And what do you feel are the advantages to this grassroots community-led approach?
Well, that's one of the really unique things about the school, is that there are many schools out there that are immersion or that are controlled by community. But that question of control is really open to interpretation. Really, how much control do you have? If you're getting funding from outside authorities, that comes with regulations, attached to that, et cetera. So in the beginning, the community members said, no, we are going to educate how we see fit. We're going to educate our own children. And it was in the late 70s, and at that time, there wasn't any kind of curriculum in the public school system for Mohawk language and culture. So they took that in their own hands and wanted to really make that change. So they don't apply. They do get some indirect funding through the Ogwesasne Mohawk Board of Education, which is on the Canadian side of the reserve. So they do get some indirect funding, but they're allowed to do what they wish with that funding. There's not any real strict attachment to that. And they do have some struggles, because they finance themselves through grants, fundraisers, and donations. And one of the big events that they have every year is an annual fundraiser. And they have a quilt auction. And there's a few pictures in the book of these amazing, unbelievably magnificent quilts. Some of these quilts auction off for around $2,000. I mean, they're so intricate. They're unbelievably gorgeous. And it really raises a lot of money for the school. In one of the years when I was doing the research there, 2004, 2005 or so, I think they raised about $25,000. So it's never quite enough, though. That's always a struggle to have enough funding. When the school first started out, teachers didn't get paid. And then a little later on, they were paid with sacks of potatoes. And sometimes they drew straws to see who would get paid that week because they just did not have enough money. But so it was really about people coming together and volunteering. And because of that, that's why it's been a success. And I had asked a few people, well, what if you got, you know, several million dollars all of a sudden? And, you know, honestly, they said, I don't think that we would be where we are today. Because we have this, because we have to clean the school. We have to make the decisions. You know, we don't have a janitor. We don't have a gymnasium. We don't have a music program. We all volunteer and we're really integrated into the school itself. We don't have a bus driver. We have to drive our kids to school. But that means we're connected. We bring them in. We see their teachers every day. If we had money to pay a bus driver, we had money to pay cleaning crew, et cetera, it would all change.
In what ways has the school tried to preserve and teach Mohawk language and culture?
It's 100% immersion, which is a real difference from some other schools out there, immersion programs that are 50-50 or at the very least they have class or two in language. All of the teachers, all of the administration, they're fluent speakers. So the office staff, they're speakers of the language. And it's really important to for the children to hear that, especially outside of the classroom. That's all you hear is Mohawk language. And there's not very many places where you can go and hear that. So the children are coming from all different backgrounds. They're coming sometimes from families, from homes where there is no language. So they're learning it as a second language. The school now just implemented a year or two ago a language nest program. So they have babies, which is fantastic. So that's where you really need to get the get them as soon as possible. Not just teaching the language or about the language. They're teaching their own history, their own culture, using the creation story, or the Ohundu Kaliwatekwa, the Thanksgiving address, the Great Love piece. They're teaching about this the culture through the language, using the language in everything that they do, which is really an effective way. It's very experiential as well. So they take the students, the children out on medicine walks and they identify medicine plants and they may pick medicine plants, and even a trip to Walmart turns into like a cultural teaching, all in the language. They're in a van and they drive off the reserve to Messina and they go to Walmart, but on the way they talk about the history of the land, they talk about the wetlands that they pass by, they go into the store and maybe they're buying supplies for that day for the school, and they're learning about counting, they're learning about money, all in the language. Then they come back to the school and then they may write about or draw pictures, depending on the age level, about their experience. So they're actually going out and living their lives in the culture and in the language. And they also partake in the ceremonial cycle as well. They really reinforce the ceremonies through the longhouse.
And one of the issues you discuss in your book is this complex relationship between language and culture. How important do you feel language is to cultural identity?
As I discuss in the book, of course, language and identity are intricately related when we're talking about Indigenous peoples, but it's not the only thing. There's many different aspects of identity. Identity is incredibly complex and multi-layered, and it's not just as simple as either you are or you aren't. So one of the things that I discovered in doing this research was that the speakers of the language, I talked to several adults, parents especially of Freedom School children, who grew up with the language. They were speakers of the language, but they grew up in the Catholic Church, for example, and they didn't know the creation story. They didn't know the Ohundu Kaliwatekwa. They didn't know the Great Law of Peace. And they felt that they were not complete. They felt that there was something missing in their own identities, which is, you know, it's language is just one of those many different aspects of identities. It's important that we also understand that just because someone is not a speaker of the language doesn't mean that they don't support the language, because you have to support it whether you speak it or not, because we have speakers who don't pass the language on. So I talk a lot about that too, about language ideologies and fear that has been instilled in parents and community members from their own education, whether it be residential schooling or public education, where they were taught that they were inferior, that their language and culture were inferior. So therefore, they don't pass the language on to their children. So it's really very complex and multi-layered, this issue of identity and language. And in terms of Mohawk identity, language is a part of that, but so is your connection to your family, kinship relations, responsibilities, various aspects of culture, songs, dances, ceremony, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, it was really very, very interesting talking to, especially those parents who said, well, I grew up knowing my language, but now, you know, I don't feel like I'm Mohawk. I don't feel like I'm completely Mohawk. What's missing? And then they started to learn through their connection with the Freedom School, learn about the creation story and the Hunikaliwatekwa and the Great Law of Peace. And they felt for the first time things were clicking and it was making sense, right? So it was really, it was a really unexpected surprise in the research.
So you think the school has really helped people find this Mohawk identity? And what other kind of impact do you think it's had on the students and the wider Mohawk community?
So what's really interesting is that when I first started out, I thought, oh, I'm going to write about language immersion. I'm going to research language immersion and I'm going to do a survey to see if these students are becoming fluent or not. Mm-hmm. I thought that was it. But then, of course, it really grew into something so much more, because what I was finding was that, well, maybe they're coming out of the school speaking the language, maybe they're not. They're really making some really solid, good attempts at that and doing it in the right way. Research shows that immersion, especially 100% immersion, is the way to do that. Even if they're not becoming fluent, they're becoming grounded in their own identities. And these kids that come out of this particular school, they go on to off-reserve high school. There's not a high school on the reserve, which they hope to change at some point at the Freedom School. But they go on to the high school. They have a little bit of difficulty transitioning, adjusting socially and educationally. But then they catch up and they excel. They go on to be on the honor societies. And then they leave. Maybe they go to university. Most of them have come back to the community to contribute to the community. One has become a traditional chief of the Mohawk Nation Council of Chiefs, and others have become teachers, come back to the school to teach themselves. They're really learning through this education system. They're learning about who they are. It's giving them a foundation in who their identity is, and then they can do anything. And success, you have to also consider what makes something successful. Is it that they graduate from university and they get a business degree or a law degree and they become rich? And does that mean success? No, because these children grow up, they are strongly rooted in their foundations. They become good parents. That's a success. That's a huge success. And a lot of them are doing that, becoming really good parents and passing on the language and culture to their own children. And that's really how success is defined in this community, in this particular school.
And the type of teaching that they use there, do they use exams at all, or students graded, or is it a whole different kind of education structure?
Yeah, they don't really do exams, and they do have report cards, but it's everything is really very different than you would see in a public school setting. They use portfolios, for example. Others assess the language just by listening, and they write notes. So it's not, you know, really you get an A, you get a B, you get a C. It's very different in that way. The teachers also can decide for themselves what they want to do. So there's no set standard throughout the whole school that you have to do it this way or that way. There's a lot of autonomy that the teachers have to adjust how they see fit for their children to learn. So it was actually kind of difficult to figure that question out. Like, well, how do you assess, how do you evaluate the children and what they're learning?
So what first inspired you to start writing the book and start looking into this school?
And I started working on my PhD in 2001, and I was taking a Gonyangeha Mohawk language course myself in central New York in the Mohawk Valley at a place called Gunaitjohalege, very close to where I grew up. I did it over two summers. I did a two-week Mohawk language immersion for adults, and it was at Gunaitjohalege. Tom Porter, who's a Mohawk elder and spiritual leader, started that community. It was there that I started to realize how important the language was, and there was a real danger to it disappearing altogether. I'm not a speaker. I mean, I still struggle, and it's difficult because I lived away from the community for so long. and you really need to be there. But I'm a real advocate for the language, and you know, I realize how important it is. And so it was through that I realized I really wanted to focus on something to do with the language. And I was also had been very interested in education for a long time, and alternative forms of education, experiential education especially. And so I went to the school and to the administrators at the time, and I said, I'm in this PhD program, I'm really interested in the language, and what can I do?
And in the preview of the book, you talk about your personal journey of discovering your own values and identities. After finishing the book, do you feel now you're closer to the answer of what it means to be fully Mohawk?
It's a lifelong endeavor. Yes, I'm certainly closer than when I started. It's been such a personal journey, just what I went through in the process of writing the book and questioning my own background and my identity. And I write a little bit about my father, who was Mohawk, and in his 80s, doing the same thing, really trying to figure out, you know, where he fit in the world and in his own identity. He grew up most of his life away from the reserve and didn't speak much of the language. So it was really this process of self-discovery and of thinking about, you know, who we are as human beings and what are our responsibilities, what is our purpose, and where do we go when we leave this earth, and et cetera, et cetera. So it really kind of evolved from there. My mother was non-native. So what it really helped me to do was to solidify kind of my background and embrace. I don't reject, you know, my mere European background, my mixed European background at all. And, you know, I really embrace at the same time that I really have come to realize what I grew up with, lessons from my father, values passed on to me from my father that at the time I didn't realize what that meant and what that was until later, because we don't always identify, this is a value, I'm teaching you a value, this is part of our value system, this is part of Mohawk identity, I'm going to teach you this now. Simple things that I took for granted at the time. So because I used to think that, well, I didn't really grow up with a culture, but what is the culture? I mean, there's a lot of different aspects, the way you carry yourself, the way you live your life. And then upon reflection, I started to realize, well, I did. I didn't know it, and I wasn't able to identify it. I just thought it was something different, you know, just the way that father would, you know, make sure that I was connected to my family. Never go to an elder's, one of our aunt's house, empty-handed. You always bring something with you. We always made our rounds when we were visiting family in Okwesasne, and to say hello and to say goodbye, and, you know, the simple things like that. And so it really became about, for me, my connection is about family and my identity.
And what do you feel is the most important message you want readers to take from your book?
I think there's a couple of messages. I think for Indigenous people is to maybe be gentle with each other, because we're all trying, we're all struggling, and because there's a lot of different attitudes out there about identity, about language. You know, there's a section entitled, "What kind of Mohawk are you if you don't know your language?" And so that there's a real negative attitude that we can put out there to each other. So I think one of the messages is that identity is really complex. And just because someone doesn't know their language, or just because someone isn't the right skin color, and, you know, we really need to get beyond those divisions. So I hope this book can help in that way, and opening up some hearts and eyes to that. And then I think for non-Indigenous people, one of the most important messages is that this is about a successful program. Yes, there's issues and there's some criticisms in the book, some things that don't work so well, but for the most part, it's a model of a successful program, a holistic Indigenous education, and what's working. And I think that other people, other communities can really look at it as a model. And I think what's also important is that we see this as an example of a community asserting their sovereign rights to education. They've done it on their own. So I think that's a message for government leaders, for policymakers, to see, okay, we know we can support this. We can support language programs. We can support language initiatives and culturally based education initiatives. A lot of times those programs that are that are funded and that are supported. Language programs, for example, it's, you know, 1 hour a week, and there's a detriment to the culture when we have to abide by, in the States, testing, state testing laws, for example, and in Canada, too. We have to think about other alternative ways of learning and knowing. How I wish you could be.